This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Now, look, I must say that in launching the book, my comments are quite impressionistic. I've only had the book since yesterday afternoon, I haven't really had time to give it the attention that it clearly deserves. It does deserve a deeper and more considered read, and I'm confident that this will be taken up in future reviews. But anyway, I'll do my best. Now, I don't know whether any of you remember John Stone. He used to be the Secretary of the Treasury, and he was also for some time the leader of the National Party in the Senate. John was a strange man, charming but strange. And I remember him telling the Parliament once that he used to lie in bed at night next to his wife reading her excerpts from the Public Accounts Committee reports. And I thought to myself, there's a strong woman. Or alternatively, a deaf one. But anyway, I have to say that last night I was lying in bed next to my wife reading the book. And we started to talk about this sort of thing, but we didn't get past the cover. We talked first of all about the wonderful photo and all the sorts of things you could get out of the photo. And then, and this is for the over 50s, I think, then we got on to the title and we talked about how academics love to use the gerund in a title. But the gerund in this title, collecting, is very appropriate. It's entirely appropriate because it implies continuity, and continuity is a very important element in this book and in the story of the 1948 expedition. I think it was William Faulkner who said, the past isn't dead, it's not even past. And that is particularly true in relation to the expedition, and it comes out very well in this book because, of course, we are still discovering aspects of the expedition, and we will continue to do so. I think the book provides us with some very useful ways of being able to take that forward. The gerund also implies, I think, the impossibility of the whole task. What exactly were these people doing in this act of collecting? What culture were they collecting? Were they collecting different cultures? Were they collecting what they liked? Were they jealously guarding their own patches of interest? This all comes out in the book, and it comes out very, very well. The third aspect that the gerund conveys is, I think, one of irony. The collecting wasn't aimed at making a collection. From the outset, the various protagonists had their own plans about splitting the acquisitions up. It's never been a collection. It may become a collection now as we start to use the wonders of the web to start talking about creating a portal where we can have access to the complete collection. But certainly the irony of collecting cultures is very much part of the book, as you will see when you read it. I think the book works on a number of different levels. First of all, it has to be said, it's a ripping yarn. Remember, this is 1948. 17 people are going into a remote area. What they're doing is not really what their masters have really decided that they're going to do, and this is something that Sally brings out in the book and something that Kim Beazley spoke about yesterday. How they survived and did their job makes fascinating reading. At times, it's almost Conradian. At other times, it's more like Gilligan's Island. But it's a fascinating picture of people at a time, and Sally reminds us, this is a time when apartheid was just being introduced in South Africa. It's a time when the Berlin Wall was going up. It's a time when the State of Israel was being created. And here is something that is happening in Australia, which is also of world significance, and it's happening with a very small group of people in an area which at the time and probably still most Australians don't know very well at all. So as a ripping yarn, as you read about the expedition and the sort of trials and travails they faced and the way they overcome them, I think Sally conveys that extremely well. You can also read it, I think, as a meditation on the human condition, or rather on human frailty. And this is particularly so, I think, in the reflection on the principal actors, Mountford, McCarthy, Jerry Blitner, Setzler. And like all good authors, Sally leaves you to make up your own mind about the participants. I went through the book feeling a wave of conflicting emotions about Mountford, for example, who clearly is the key figure. What an excellent portrait of Mountford it is. A man who could have walked out of, or into, the pages of a Patrick White novel. Going back to John Stone, I wonder what Mountford said to Mrs. Mountford when he turned in for the night, as the situation sort of developed. I imagine their conversations would have been particularly interesting as the exhibition went on, and Mountford unravelled a bit. Mountford, in that sense, reminds me a little bit of Captain Cook on his third voyage. You know, his health declines, problems get harder and harder, paranoia sets in, things start to unravel, and particularly after the attempt to replace him as a leader of the expedition, you know, the whole atmospherics, the whole approach to his task changes. And this is very dramatic reading, and I think Sally captures that very, very well indeed. The third way it can be read, and an important way, is as a case history, a case study, in the history of Australian anthropology. When I was growing up, being a cricket fan, there always used to be a very important game on the cricket calendar in England. It was the gentlemen versus players game. And it basically put the idle rich and those with nothing better to do, who also could play cricket quite well, against the professionals who had to play it for a living. And there was always a great deal of interest in the result and a great deal of feeling in Australia, I think, of total support for the players rather than the gentlemen. But leave that aside. I mean, I was reminded of this when I read this book. I mean, because clearly there is a gentleman and players element in Australian anthropology at the time. And I understand that John Mulvaney spoke about this a bit yesterday. And what comes across, I think, is how bloody nasty it could get at times. I mean, it was a hard business. People didn't like each other. It wasn't just that gentlemen didn't like players. I mean, professionals didn't like professionals. Everybody wanted to carve out their own patch. They wanted to protect their own institution. And the consequences, I think, were profound and still are profound for collecting institutions and for Australian anthropology. And I think that's another thing that comes across very well. And that leads into, I think, one of the keys that Sally has in the book, which is about the myths and politics of collecting in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. How the people viewed what they were collecting, how they built their biases into their collections, how these biases transferred to the cultural institutions in the eventual split-up of the material, and how this has subsequently affected those institutions and whether they are museums or galleries and whether they realise it or not. The third element in this history of anthropology at the time is that comes through to me is the prevalence and perniciousness of social Darwinism and its effect on the collectors and their subjects. And if I can quote Sally, "It is hard to understand that even as recently as 1948, people still believed that Aboriginal Australians were a dying race. Yet it was not as simple as believing the peoples themselves were dying out. It was the cultural death of Aboriginal Australia that they anticipated and feared, the polluting of cultural beliefs and practices by outside influences." And I think this element comes through in the book very, very well indeed. The fourth way you can read the book, and I think an important way too, a very important way, is as an important step in the process of providing justice to Aboriginal people and allowing them to reclaim their rightful role in the expedition. As Sally once again puts it, there was a clear lack of understanding relating to the impact of the expedition on the Aboriginal men and women who were considered the subjects, I first of all wrote objects, but subjects is what she says, of this research. There is no evidence to suggest that any consideration was given to the implications of this expedition for Aboriginal communities. Now, clearly from the book, it is not that the information was not available. They only had to ask. I mean, here, Jerry Blitner, for example, he remembers warning Mountford that the ceremonies were not play dances and that he must appreciate the Aboriginal sense of it all. Clearly, this fell on deaf ears. This book, and this conference too, I'm pleased to say, allows the Aboriginal voices to be heard. As such, it reopens the expedition, and this is, I think, very important. It also sends a clear message to us as collecting institutions that unless we fully involve the Aboriginal communities in the presentation of our collections, or their collections, and in the accompanying information, we are seriously distorting the history we are trying to tell. I won't dwell on the removal of human remains. It is an episode of shame and sadness for us all. But the research that led to this book, happily, has prompted the return of a good number of those remains. And I was most gratified yesterday to hear Kim Beasley express an interest in seeing the return of the remainder of the collection from the Smithsonian in his capacity as ambassador designate to the United States. And that is an enormous step forward, I think. Well done. The fifth way I think you can read the book, and I'm almost finished, you can read it as an exhortation to collecting institutions to have a better understanding of what they are doing. Always a good thing for collecting institutions to have. Sally May quotes Susan Pierce. Objects have lives which, though finite, can be very much longer than our own. They have the power, in some sense, to carry the past into the present by virtue of their real relationship to past events. Particularly Aboriginal objects, I might add, as Howard Morphy, for example, has argued powerfully and to me very convincingly. Now, quoting Susan Pierce again, museums have appropriated culture in many ways. All of our collections were made with political agendas, albeit unconscious ones, in mind, and all bear the indelible marks of the context from which they arose once we choose to look at them. At the NMA, I think we've learned this, we know it well. A recent example where we've had to come to terms with this was our debate with our council about the Queenie Mackenzie painting of the Mistake Creek Massacre and what place that had in the museum. It's an important area and one that we should never forget. As Sally reminds us, museums have an obligation to try and understand themselves so that they can understand more clearly what messages they are giving and how these are received. We can't be reminded too often, I believe, of this most important responsibility. So let me conclude by saying that this is a terrific book. Sorry I haven't been able to do it justice in the short period of time. The book is informed by a great deal of knowledge about which there has been a considerable amount of thought. Yet I think it wears its learning lightly, and it's a pleasure to read. Sally, among many other activities, is currently a lecturer of heritage, museums and material culture in the Research School of Humanities at the Australian National University. As such, she is responsible for training the next generation of museum and gallery curators. It is a great comfort to know that they are in such good hands. So now, finally, it gives me great pleasure to proclaim this book, Collecting Cultures, Myth, Politics and Collaboration in the 1948 Arnhem Land Expedition by Dr. Sally K. May, launched. And I'm confident that will go much better than, for example, the Barge Phoenix. Thank you very much indeed.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.